My name is Doug Rowell. I'm a grateful alcoholic and grateful to be an alcoholic, grateful to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to thank Billy for inviting me to come and do this. I really kind of expected, you know, to read the steps or the, you know, traditions or say something, or maybe somebody to be celebrating an anniversary. I didn't know I was going to jump right into it. So that's fine with me. It's 3 o'clock here in California. So, my home group is the Winner's Attitude Adjustment Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We meet every day of the year at 7 a.m. Pacific time. And I just put, the website, our website in the, chat there. If anybody wants to join us, just come to that website and there's a link to our meeting, 7 o'clock every morning at the Pacific time. So you guys could get up and have breakfast and go for a hike and get a couple hours work done by 10, probably. Take a coffee break and come to our meeting anyway. My sobriety date is June 7th of 1987. And so I haven't had a drink in a very long time. My wife Carla has been sober almost as long as I have. She'll be 33 years sober this coming Friday. And I have mixed emotions about that because I act the period from June to September. If we go to some of these conventions and alcathons and things where they have a countdown and they say 33 years and I stand up, and then when they say 32, I point to my wife graciously. And so, you know, half of the year, every time we have a disagreement, I can say, just wait 3 months, honey, you'll understand. She says, yeah, those are man months. They don't count. So anyway, I'm delighted to be here, and I'm glad Billy asked me to come and talk about the eighth and ninth steps. And I had some immense, you know, we come in here and say, a lot of us say, before we get sober, look, I understand I drink too much. I'm not hurting anybody but myself. You know, just leave me alone. I heard a guy in Texas. I was at a meeting, and it was an anniversary meeting at the Arlington Group in Texas, near Dallas. And this guy took a chip for 5 years, and he said, you know, when I first come in here, I thought of everybody just leave me alone, and I could get my ducks in a row, then I could solve my own damn problems. And then when I was a year sober, I realized that the only one standing in the way of me getting my ducks in a row is me. And he said, now I'm 5 years sober and pretty clear they ain't even my ducks. And I thought, couldn't be said better. I like that. And I heard another guy take a cake for 3 years of sobriety in Laguna Beach. And he said, promises are coming true for me. I no longer fear financial insecurity. I have achieved it. And, so anyway, I'm delighted to come and talk. We had, you know, I was one of those people that said, sometimes I'm not hurting anybody but myself, you know, oh, look, Ma, ain't it grand, the wind stopped blowing. And it was an incident. My mother said to me, I was about, I don't know, 3, maybe 4 years sober. And my mother said, do you remember a time when I called you and you were working on your car and you said you were going to buy a bicycle? I said, yeah, I do remember that. She said, I could always tell when you were drunk because you didn't slur your words, but you repeated everything. But she said, I said, yeah, I remember that. I was working on my brakes and I had my wheels apart, and I realized I needed a part from the parts house. So I had to put my brakes back on and my wheels back on, put my car back together so I could go to the store and buy the part I needed and come back and take everything apart again. And I said, yeah, I thought I'm gonna go buy a bicycle. So when I'm in this situation, I can just get on my bike and go to the parts house and get what I need and come back. She said, yeah, yeah, that's it. She said, after we hung up from that conversation, I said to your dad, well, it won't be long now till it's, you know, Doug, that old drunk that rides around Tahunga on a bicycle. And I was shocked because I had to think how many layers of surrender and pain does a mother have to go through to say about her firstborn son, her firstborn child, her only son. It won't be long now till it's Doug, that old drunk that rides around Tahunga on a bicycle. And, you know, we don't know the pain that we're causing sometimes. I had a little girl. Her mother and I hooked up, and we were together for about 3 years. And then I was not faithful to her, and I was rarely sober and drinking and using and going around. I have to take my daughter with me to go meet some girl in a bar and in the daytime when her mom's at work and cheat on her mother with me, you know, and things like that. And finally her mother just said, I can't do this anymore. I know you love your daughter. I want you to stay in her life, but not in mine. You just get the hell out of here. So I did stay in my daughter's life, and I would pick her up after school sometimes. And she would stay with me until her mom got home from work. And that's the way she grew up. And we'd spend weekends together sometimes. When she was about 12, I went to pick her up. I was supposed to be there at noon on a Saturday and pick her up. We were going to go see a movie. We were going to have dinner and then to spend the night at my house, and we'd go visit friends on Sunday, and then Sunday evening I'd bring her home. That was the deal. And I got there. I was there at noon like I was supposed to be, and I was already drunk. And I swear to you, I did not mean to be drunk. I knew I was going to be spending the day with my daughter, and my intention was not to get drunk first. But I don't know what happened exactly. I mean, it's easy to figure out. I probably got up and have a beer for breakfast, you know, like people do. And somewhere maybe thought, I'm not going to be drinking with Star in the car. So maybe I better switch to whiskey and get a load. I don't know. But anyway, I was drunk. And I knew I was drunk. And I tried to act like I wasn't. And I didn't fool anybody. And her stepfather, nice guy, we were friends. He said, he walked me out on the front porch. He said, Doug, you're drunk. And I said, yeah, I am. And he said, well, I'm not letting Star get in the car with you. And I didn't have any argument for that. He was absolutely right. I knew he was right. And there was, I would have given anything to be sober at that moment, because I was looking forward to spending the weekend with my kid. And she was too. And I said to Stu, I said, Stu, I'm sorry. I get it, you know, but I was really looking forward to this. And he said, so was she. So were we. But it's not going to happen. And he said, this is what he said to me, syllable for syllable. I'll never forget. It's burned in my brain. He said, Doug, you know, you're welcome in our home anytime. Sober. Don't come over here drunk anymore. It's very hard on Star. He didn't say, don't come over here drunk. We're afraid you're going to embarrass us in front of the neighbors or break our nice furniture or fall in the pool. Or he said, don't come over here drunk. It's very hard on Star. He's protecting my only child from me. And that's what a good father does. And what I did was what a bad father does, what a drunk father does. I wasn't necessarily a bad father. I was a drunk father. But at that moment, I couldn't tell any difference. I didn't know what alcoholism was. I thought I had a choice. I thought I made a choice to be drunk when I went to pick up my kid. And I said, Stu, it won't happen again. And I never once again went over there drunk, but I didn't get sober for 3 more years. I got in the car, started to drive home, And I got about halfway down the block and the tears started to come. It's like Niagara Falls. I couldn't even see to drive. I'm trying to wipe, turn on the windshield wipers, which turns out was not any help at all. And, I got out on the main drag and I couldn't see to drive. I pulled in this little strip mall and, opened the door and put my feet on the pavement, my head in my hands, and I just sobbed like a baby. And I looked up and I saw this red neon sign that said liquor. And I walked in that liquor store and I gave the guy a $10 bill and he gave me a pint of whiskey. And I got back to the car, cracked the top on that bottle, had a pull off it. And then I had another one. I had this pain of embarrassment and shame that felt like a knife in my heart and felt like it would never stop hurting. And I had to swallow that whiskey and a second swallow and that pain gone just like that. Just like that. That's what alcohol does for me. And whenever they say, why you drink so much? And I want to say, why don't you? You know? And the reason, of course, is because alcohol doesn't do for everybody what it does for us. And it's funny, I see a couple of heads nodding in here. Anytime I tell this story in an AA meeting, there's heads nodding because you understand that. 90% of the people on the planet, the most sensitive, long-time aware Al-Anon, non-alcoholic Al-Anon, understands that there's something like that, but doesn't know what it feels like, can't imagine what it feels like. But alcoholics, if you're long-time sober or brand new, haven't quit drinking yet, understand that. Understand that. That alcohol takes away that pain and quick. Quick. And so it took me a while. I never again went over there drunk. I was sober when I went over there. Or sometimes I'd be on the way and realize I was drunk. I'd turn around or I'd stop at a payphone, call them and say I had car trouble or something, make some excuse. Same thing with my daughter's school. If I'm going to go see her play soccer or be in a play or something, if I realized I was drunk on the way, I'd turn around and go home, because there have been too many times where I showed up there drunk and embarrassed her and disappointed her. And how do you make amends for that? You know, our book talks, our steps 8 and 9 that Billy asked me to talk about. Step 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. And step 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. And that's pretty simple stuff. My friend Scott Redmond used to say, he was at a meeting and asked some new person to read the chapter 5, and he got there and said, step 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed, became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made the, holy shit, did anybody read this? You know, that's the way sometimes, really? That's, I don't know. I'm not sure I want to quit drinking, but if I have to do that to quit, I'll be back. I forgot I got some errands to take care of. But we had, you know, in the big book, there's a, Bill talks about this example of a guy at the big book. And I've heard a lot of people, in fact, most people, it seems, in AA, when they hear this story, they say, wow, what courage. Here's the story. This brings to mind the story about a friend of ours. While drinking, he accepted a sum of money from a bitterly hated business rival, giving him no receipt for it. He subsequently denied having received money and used the incident as a basis for discrediting the man. He thus used his own wrongdoing as a means of destroying the reputation of another. In fact, it says, in fact, his rival was ruined. Ruined. He felt that he had done a wrong which he could not possibly make right. If he opened that old affair, he was afraid it would destroy the reputation of his partner, because we're always thinking about the welfare of somebody else, of his partner, disgrace his family, and take away his means of making a livelihood. What right had he to involve those dependent upon him? How could he possibly make a public statement exonerating his rival? Exonerating is the word they use here. What about restoring? Exonerating his rival. After consulting with his wife and his partner, he came to the conclusion that it was better to take those risks than to stand before his creator guilty of such ruinous slander. He saw that he had to place the outcome in God's hands, or he would soon start drinking again. He attended church for the first time in many years. After the sermon, he quietly got up and made an explanation. His actions were met with widespread approval, and today he is one of the most trusted citizens of our town. This all happened years ago. This action that so many people I've heard say, that was such a courageous act. Yeah. It was a good start. But what I've been told is, when I say, I told my mom, I'm sorry I hurt you. I told my daughter, I'm sorry that I disappointed and embarrassed you, and my sponsors would say, oh, the word that's used in the eighth and ninth step is amends. It means to make whole, to make right. Not to say I'm sorry. Now, in the case with my mom, there was nothing I could do except what we call a living amends. Same thing with my daughter. Although my daughter, after I got sober, I made amends to her. I apologized. I said I was not a good father. She said, you're a good father. You're fun. We had a lot of fun, and we did have a lot of fun together. We played all the time. When I pick her up from school, we would play and make up games and stuff, word games and things, and I would do characters and stuff. But I disappointed and embarrassed her a lot, but we did have a lot of fun over the years. But she said we had fun, and she said, don't you remember one time you sent me a card, like a greeting card, like a birthday card? It wasn't even my birthday. You just sent me, I got a card in the mail from you. And I made a note of, I said, yeah, I do remember. She said, yeah, I'm glad you're not drinking, Dad, but don't worry about it. That's okay. But you know what? I one thing I started doing every week, I sent her a card. And at first it was like, oh, you did it again. You remember that? And he sent me a card. And then the next week I sent her another one. And so she kind of got, and after about 7 weeks, she said, and she just lived about 20 miles away from me. So it's not like, it's not like she lived across the country. After about 7 weeks, she said, are you going to literally send me a card? She's like 15 years old. You going to send me a card every week? And I said, yeah, till I feel like it's been enough. And so I did that for a while. I don't know, maybe about 3 months, I sent her a card every week. And you just do what you can do to make amends. But this guy, this example in the book, when they say he took some money, didn't give him a receipt, then he claimed the guy didn't give him the money, and it ruined him. And there's no explanation of the word ruin, so we don't know. But if it ruined him, I'd say it put him out of business. I don't know if his wife left him, if his relatives said, you're a liar and a cheat, I don't know if they ran him out of town on a rail. We don't know what ruin means, what level of ruin. My sponsors told me we make amends, we make things right, we make the person whole. If it was money, we certainly do. We go to a church that we haven't been to in years, and after the sermon stand up and say, excuse me, everybody. I know I'm not a member of this church, but I got something to say. People, what? Yeah, that's Mr. Brown. Mr. Brown. Yeah, he never comes here. Yeah, well, I took some money from Mr. Green down at the livery stable, And I said he didn't give it to me, but he did give it to me. And, you know, he lost his business and people sued him. And again, you know, he finally left town. So I just want you all to know that he did give me the money. And they go, oh my gosh, now you're a trusted member of this community. But here's the thing. We didn't have the examples in 1934 when this book was written. We didn't have the examples that we have today. You know, we didn't have my friend Tom S. that was a junkie and an alcoholic, and he went to prison because he would burglarize house every day, and he finally got caught and he went to prison. And when he got sober in prison, and when he got out, he got Clint H. as his sponsor, and Clint told him, you know, and what making amends is making it right for the harms that you did. And so what Tom did, now this is the kind of courage that we talk about. Tom went around to every house that he remembered burglarizing. And of course, you don't remember them all because he committed a crime every day. But he went around to every house that he remembered, and he'd go up and say, did you live here in 1979? And of course, most people said, no, we didn't, because it had been like 13 years or 14 years. But a lot of people did say, yeah, we did. And Tom would say, I'm a drug addict, recovering drug addict. I'm sober 4 years or 5 years, whatever it was. And I robbed this house. I burglarized your house and I stole stuff from you. Do you remember that? And the people who lived there said, yeah, they did remember it. And he said, I'd like you to sit down and make a list of the things that I stole and the value of them at the time. And here's my phone number. Call me and I want to start paying you back. That's what Tom did. And he said there was one guy and said, I know what it was. It was $5,000. Tom was pretty sure that he didn't take, but there were some houses that he didn't get to, you know, that he couldn't make amends. And he laid it out. He said, tell me what you think I stole and I'll pay you back. So Tom started making payments to him and some other people. But the main thing, the big event was he stopped at one house. Did you live here in 79? Yes, we did. He said, my name is Tom. I'm a drug addict. I'm sober. I'm clean. I want to make amends for harms that I did. I burglarized this house in 1979. And the woman, her chin dropped. And she said, would you come in and tell my husband that? And he said, sure. So he walked in and she introduced him to the husband. And he told him what he did. And the husband and wife hugged each other and cried. And she said, we always thought it was our son, you know. And Tom used to get asked a lot to talk about steps 8 and 9 because of that experience. And Tom said, you know, my sponsor said, you throw a pebble in the pond and you're not responsible for where the ripples go. And one of those ripples is that at that time, years later, they were able to forgive their son. And who knows what abrasions there were between the mother and father and their son over that period of time. I had some amends that I had to make. I worked as a stagehand in Los Angeles. Sometimes I was a prop man on shows, and sometimes I was an electrician hanging lights and stuff, or a grip moving walls. One of the things that my union did was build sets. And I was working in the American Broadcasting Company in their scene shop. And I was had a good reputation in there. But they asked me they were taping a show in a stage next door. And they asked me if I would stay. They have a standby carpenter in case anything gets broken during the taping of a show. So there'll be a carpenter there to repair it. And so And it's a great job because you've already done your 8 hours at least. Now you're on overtime, staying there doing nothing, drinking coffee, reading, you know, watching TV if you want. And so I got bored and I walked around and I found a dressing room from one of the empty stages and went in and turned on the TV. And it occurred to me that I could walk into this dressing room and it was unlocked. So I went back to I got up my tape measure and I measured the television. I went back to the shop and I built a box to hold that television, a box on wheels. And I wheeled it back to the dressing room, put the TV in it, took it back, nailed it up in the shop, and left it till the next morning when I came to work and told them I made this toolbox and I took it home. And one of the amends, I was 2 years sober, and I went back to my union steward and told him what I did. And he said, well, I know who to talk to over there. First, I told him I stole some things. He said, listen, stagehands steal from this. They work that into their budgets. You know, we take light bulbs, we take a roll of tape, you know, they're used to that kind of loss. I said, this was a state-of-the-art colored television I took. This is not a roll of tape. And he said, okay, well, I'll tell you, I know who you need to talk to over at ABC. And by that time, I wasn't working in the shop anymore. I was sober and I was working on American Bandstand. And anyway, he gave me the name of the guy at ABC who was in charge of stage operations. It's the guy that fired me for drunkenness. And I said, I could have prayed and got that answer. So I called the guy and I made an appointment to come in and talk to him. And I went in to talk to him. And he said, I'm surprised to hear from you. What's up? And I told him what I did. And he said, I remember that incident very well. As a matter of fact, because of that incident, nobody knew how that TV got out of there. There's nothing on any kind of security cameras or anything. TV was just gone. I remember it well. And what happened was it changed our security system. It totally changed the way we did security on the lot because of you. And I said, you're welcome. And he said, you still have the TV? And I said, I do. And he said, well, bring it back. And I said, I'll bring it back if you want. But that TV was a brand new state-of-the-art television when I took it. It was a big RCA X200. And that was the state of the art then. This is 6-7 years later, and now you have flat screen TVs. You're never gonna, you know, the TV is not worth what it was when I took it. And he said, you know how much it was worth? And I said, I do. It was worth $500 at the time. And he said, okay, we'll say $500. We won't even deal with the interest over 7 years. We'll just say $500 plus. You used that. Now, we were paying you overtime to steal that TV, but we had to pay you overtime anyway. See, that's what this guy figured out, how much things cost. That's his job. He said, did you use that 3/4 ply, double side solid cord? Yeah. Oh, yes. Sure. I did. And how about the wheels? Did you use, you bet you use those double wheeled car Darnell $25 casters? Yes, I did. And he said, okay. So he said, I'm coming up with $800. How's that sound? I said, sounds right. And I said, I don't have $800 to write you a check right now. I would if I, but I'd like to make payments. And he said, yeah, well, let me tell you something. I can get that money back into the system. I can work it back into the system, but it's a pain in the ass. And I might have to account for it at some time. What I would rather do is I wrote down what you did here. What it costs. I'd like you to sign this piece of paper. I'm going to put it in my desk. And I've been hearing good things about you, Doug. And I'll tell you this. I'm going to put that, you sign that piece of paper. I'll put it in my desk. And if I ever hear of you taking a drink or a drug, I'm pulling this out. I'm going to the union and we'll get our money back. I said, okay. Thank you. There was another incident where, I had a girlfriend. We both worked for the Stagehands Union, and she worked at that time. She worked at ABC, at CBS, and I worked at ABC. And she finally got tired of my drinking and using. We did a little drinking together, but she was not an alcoholic. And my drinking got worse and worse and worse, and it stopped being fun for her. And, you know, we'd smoke a joint once in a while, maybe even do a little coke together, but she wasn't an addict. And finally she had enough of me. People fall in love with me because I'm a pretty lovable guy. And, you know, and I have a lot of interesting things about me, but they usually have had enough of me at some point and just move on. And so that's what she did. And she started going out with a guy and she worked with at CBS, and she lived about 3 blocks from me. So I would be out. One night I was out drinking and I came by and I went by her house, only like 2 or 3 blocks out of the way to drive by her house. You know, we do that. We stalk them a little bit. And I saw his car out there in front of her house. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. So it irritated me. So I went home and I walked back to his car and I stole his car. I drove it up. We lived in the Hollywood Hills, and I drove it up. I was going to drive it up to the Hollywood sign and leave it there and walk home. But it's about a mile, and I didn't feel like walking home at 2:30 in the morning drunk. So I just crashed it into a wall and caved in the whole passenger side of his car, and then drove it back to where it was parked. You know, with the wheel rubbing against the bent fender, parked it back where it was, with the sidewalk side crashed in. See, so it couldn't have got hit by some car driving down the street. So, you know, when he came out in the morning, saw it, and I also took some stuff out of his car. I went through, he left his briefcase in there, and I went through the briefcase, and I took his address book, because I knew that would cause him a problem, and a family checkbook from his family's business in Texas. And I thought, well, this is going to cause him a lot of problems, and slow was the car, and walked home. And when I was 2 years sober, I thought, I need to make amends for this. And I took the address book and the checkbook, and I wrote him a letter, and I said, Smokey, I'm the one that crashed your car, and I heard that your insurance company canceled you. They didn't believe you, and I know I caused you problems. I intentionally caused you problems. I was drunk. I'm sober now 2 years, and in order to stay sober, I have to make amends for harms that I did. So I don't know how much this cost you, but I know it cost you a lot. And if you can figure that out and tell me, I want to pay you back. And I never heard back from him. In fact, the letter came back. The package came back and said, doesn't live here anymore. Because I had his address, but he had moved. So I thought, I don't know where he moved to. And I had his address book, so I called his father's office in Texas, and I talked to his dad's secretary, and I said, I'm a friend of Smokey's, and I sent him a letter to his address in Hollywood, and it came back, and I don't have his new address. Do you have the new address? And she said, oh, sure. Yeah, what's your name? And I told her my name, and she said, yeah, and she gave me the address. So I put the package in another package, and I mailed it to the new address, and I never heard from him. And it must have been 8 or 9 months later, maybe, when I never heard from him. And I know he got it. And so I had a call. I had a nighttime call at CBS to work on some soap opera and change the sets overnight. And as I got there, he was leaving. And I saw him in the parking lot. I said, Smokey. He turned around and I said, it's Doug Rowell. He came over and he said, Doug, and he hugged me. And he said, and I said, did you get my letter? Yes. Yeah, I did. You went to a lot of trouble to do that. I said, I got the number from your dad's secretary, but your address. But I didn't go to any kind of trouble like I caused you. And he said, you said that in your letter. And I also told him the letter, if you want to go to the police, I'll take responsibility for that damage. But what I'd rather do is pay you back what it costs. I said, did you figure out what it cost you? He said, don't worry about it. He said, we were both drinking and using drugs back then. I don't know if, I've accepted Christ in my life and, my life has turned around. Do you know God? I said, Smokey, if I didn't know God, you never would have got that letter. Yeah. Yeah, I have a God in my life. I have a God that I did not believe in, that I used to make fun of when I, a couple of years ago, and God saved my life. And that's why I'm sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, yeah, yeah, I know a lot of people in that outfit. And, he said, I'm so happy for you. And, you know, Nancy and I aren't together anymore. I said, yeah, I heard him that. And so he hugged me and he went off. And so those were two big amends that I tried to, two big transactions that I tried to make. Then ended up not costing me anything. And I told my sponsor, and my sponsor said, put an extra buck in the basket, And also, I had a thing when I was a long time sober. My daughter lives in Santa Barbara, and I went up to see my grandson in this musical presentation. And I had to go the next morning. I had to get on a plane at 6 a.m. At LAX and fly to a conference somewhere across the country. And so I was up there at this event in Santa Barbara, 100 miles north of where I live. And I left after his performance was over, and the venue kept going. I went out and I got in my car and I backed up out of the parking lot and I backed into a car. And I got out and looked at the car, and I had backed into the bumper and didn't look like it did any damage. So I drove off and I got down the block and I'm hearing this and I got out and a piece of the bumper and the license plate had come off under my bumper and rubbing against my wheel. And I said, and I'm sober. I'm sober like 14, 15 years. And, but the event isn't over. I can't walk in there and say, there's somebody, this is a big multiple high school event and there's maybe 3,000 people. And, I can't say, does anybody know who owns this license plate? So I went and put it back by the car, and I don't know what to do. So I just drove home, and I felt bad about it. I told my sponsor, and he said, well, you remember the license plate number? I said, no, I should have. I should have written the license plate. Maybe I should have kept the plate, but I don't have any idea how to find out. He said, well, you can ask your daughter if anybody complained about the thing. And I said, yeah. I can ask her. I don't think she's going to know anything about it. He said, I'll tell you what you do. Find somebody in AA who needs to renew their car license and doesn't have the money. And you offer to pay to renew their license. And I said, okay, I can do that. So I didn't do it for a while. And then I was at a Saturday morning meeting where where the topic was amends, and it was a speaker talks for 20 minutes and then they open it up. And I said, yeah, I told them what I did, and people are going, oh my God, Doug, Doug, really? I said, yeah. But my sponsor said, I need to find somebody who needs to renew their license on their car and doesn't have the money, and I'll pay for it. And this girl raised her hand. She goes, yeah, I have to renew my license. It's due on Tuesday, and I don't have the money, and I think I'm going to be touching. Okay. How much is it? She said $125. Okay. So I wrote her a check, and that was like an amends that I made. I never, you know, sometimes we do things that we never should do, even if we're not drinking. Can't blame everything on booze. But I had an instance also when I was 2 years sober. I look back at this, and somehow when I got 2 years sober, I really started. I had taken these steps, but to actually get into the meat of it and make amends where I owed money. And I said to my dad and I were at my daughter's high school graduation. And I said, listen, I owe you some money. I had borrowed money from him, and I paid some back, and I borrowed some more, and then I paid some back. And sometimes it was child support, and sometimes it was to buy a motorcycle, whatever, you know. But I had paid him back some, and I figured I owed him somewhere between $2,000 and $3,000. I really hadn't kept good track of it. But I said to my dad, I owe you some money, and I want to pay you. And he said, don't worry about it. I said, I'm not worried about it. I want to pay you. And he said, listen, your mom and I are so happy that you're sober in AA. You're doing a good job, Doug. You're the man we hoped you would be. You're a good father. You're a good son. You're a good husband. That's all we asked, really. We couldn't ask for more. And I said, that's fine for you. But we have these, you've heard of these 12 steps. Well, step 9 says we made amends for harms that we did. And I think borrowing money and not paying it back is a harm. And he said, yeah. And I said, yeah, if I don't pay you back, I may not stay sober. And he said, oh, well, I didn't know that. I said, do you know how much it is? He said, no, I don't know, but I got it in the computer. I don't need it. I don't want it. Just like to look at it once in a while, you know. I don't want to chip a nail on that delete button or anything. So he went home and he got it on the computer and he printed out everything I borrowed and everything I paid back, and he sent it to me. A balance sheet, and it was $7,200 and change. Oh, man, so many times I was going to save up $3,000. Hey, Dad, you know the money I borrowed? Here it is, you know. And I figured he would say, oh, it's not that much, you know. Just call it interest, Pop, you know. This is a fantasy I had in my head. I've met hundreds of people in AA that were going to do that. I've met one who claimed that he actually did that, saved up the money and gave it to somebody. But I'm glad I didn't do it, because, you know, he would have said, $3,000, well, you're a little light, but I appreciate the effort, you know. So I started sending him a check. Every Friday, I sent him a check and a note. I heard Sharon C. say that. That's what she did with her dad. She sent a check and a note. And she got done paying him off, and he said, don't quit sending the notes. So I sent my dad a check and a note every Friday, and it wasn't anything set up. Sometimes 20, 30 bucks, you know, if I had a tight week, sometimes 100 or 200, you know, usually it was between 30 and 50, but I'd send him a check and a note every single Friday. And after about 3 years, he called me and he said, I got your check. And I said, is there a problem with it? There never is a problem. I've never had a problem with your checks. You know how much you owe me? And I said, no, I don't. I haven't been keeping track of it. And he said, you owe me $32. I said, I knew it was under 1,000, but it didn't seem like it could be 32. I said, are you sure? And he said, oh, you know I am. He's the one who keeps track. So he's an engineer, you know. And so we met for dinner, and I gave him his check for $32, and he gave me a printout sheet, balanced down to zero. Everything I borrowed, everything I paid back, no interest. He didn't charge me any interest, but I got that debt paid off. and I let him pay for dinner. Because every time I ate with my dad, you know, out eating out, I'd say, Dad, let me get this. And whether it was with the family or just the two of us, no, no, it's the father's job to feed his family. I'll get it. And I'd say, come on, Dad, you know, let me buy dinner. It's the father's job to feed his family, all right? Sometimes there were times when the family was eating someplace and I would go find the waitress and put this on my credit card and put 15% for yourself on there, you know, and then hope that the credit card was okay. But I had to sneak around. Once I got that debt paid off, I could hear my dad say, it's a father's job to feed his family. If I took over the meal, paying for the meal, he felt I cheated him. And I understood that. He thought he was supposed to pay for dinner. And if I paid for it, I was cheating. And the thing is, I realized then, when I did that, in my heart of hearts, whether I realized it or not, I was saying, damn, God, Doug, Dad, I owe you all this money. Please, at least let me buy dinner. And once that debt was paid, we were cool. We were all right. My dad lived for a good long time after that. And when I was about 10 years sober, he had gotten cancer, and he was slowly going down. He had to have a lot of treatments, a couple of treatments. He had to have blood transfusions a couple times a week, you know, and he was deteriorating. And I had to finally, just before the end, I was watching him, taking care of him while my mom was working. And I laid on that. My mom said, you know, would you tell your dad that I need to talk to him about his dying? I can't bring it up. And so I said, I lay there on my dad's bed and I said, Dad, do you know you're dying? He said, I hope not. I said, no, you are. You're not going to live more than a couple more days. And he said, okay. So the reason I'm saying this is because mom needs to talk to you and she can't bring it up. You're going to have to bring it up to her. And he said, okay, I can do that. And so he did, and they talked about whatever they had. My mom said that he said, you know what you're going to bury me in? And she said, we have Neptune Society. You're not going to need a suit. And they talked about whatever they had to talk about. But I was there on my dad's deathbed just before the end, hours before the end. And after he died, I went down to help my mom go through some financial stuff she needed to clear up. And in my dad's file cabinet, there was a file that said Doug. And I pulled it out and I opened it. It was all these notes that I had sent him over 3 years, like 150 notes just fell out of him. Sometimes, you know, they were on notebook paper or sometimes just on a post-it that was stuck to the check, but he saved every one of them. There's a fat file of 150 notes. And when I opened it, I knew what it was. I said to my mother, did you know he saved these? She said, yeah. Every Monday morning when your check would come in the mail, he'd come home from work and he'd walk in and he'd open the thing and he'd put the check in his pocket and he would read me the note. And then he would take the note from last week, put the note on the table, on the dining room table, take last week's note and go put it in the file cabinet. Now, I visited him a lot during that 3 years, and I never saw any notes on the table. So I can only assume that if he knew I was coming down, he wouldn't leave the note on the table. He didn't want me to know that he'd left them on the table. Sometimes he said he'd come home from work, he'd be tired, and he'd pick up last week's note, and he'd read it and smile, put it down. And she said, I told him one time, you know, Doug sure loves you. And he said, I know that. Yeah, I got it in his own handwriting. And when my father was dying, I was at his deathbed hours before he died. And I said, I don't know if you know this, Dad. Everything good about me came from you. And he said, it's not true. I said, it is true. You're the one who taught me, who showed me how to be a father, how to be a husband, how to be a son, how to be a brother, how to be a neighbor, how to be an employee, how to be an employer. I got all that from you. You taught me that. That's everything good about me. And he said, well, you have AA. He said, you have AA. And he was right. Everything that my dad taught me that I couldn't put into practice, I learned it, but I couldn't put it into practice until I came to you and you took me through those 12 steps and I developed integrity. I developed compassion. I developed honesty and faith. And I became the man my parents wanted to raise. And Chuck C. used to say, I came in here a dirty glass full of dirty water. And you started a steady stream of clear water, replaced the dirty water, and started to clean the glass. And somewhere along the line, I can't mark it, but I became a clean glass full of clean water because of you. And I couldn't say it better than that. Thank you for giving me back my life and giving my family back. Doug, thanks for letting me share.